UAB Medcast is an ongoing medical education podcast. The UAB Division of Continuing Education designates that each episode of this enduring material is worth a maximum of 0.25 AMA PRA Category 1 credit. To collect credit, please visit uabmedicine.org/medcast and complete the episode's post-test.
Welcome to UAB Medcast, a continuing education podcast for medical professionals. Bringing knowledge to your world, here's Melanie Cole.
Welcome. Our topic today is new ways to approach pancreatic cancer. And my guests in this panel discussion today is Dr. Bart Rose. He's a hepatobiliary and pancreatic surgeon in surgical oncology. Dr. Ravi Kumar Palluri, he's a hematologist and medical oncologist. And Dr. Rojiman Jacob, he's a radiation oncologist, and they're all at UAB Medicine. Dr. Rose, I'd like to start with you. Explain a little bit about pancreatic cancer and the prevalence of this type of cancer today.
Sure. I think when we talk about pancreatic cancer, we're mostly talking about adenocarcinoma of the pancreas as opposed to neuroendocrine tumors. Adenocarcinoma of the pancreas is the fourth leading cause of cancer-related deaths in the United States. There's going to be about 55,000 new cases this year. And unfortunately, about 44,000 of those people will die, including 750 deaths here in the state of Alabama.
Wow, that's quite a prevalence and statistic. So, Dr. Palluri, tell us a little bit about the etiology of pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma.
So the risk factors, the causative factors for this pancreatic cancer, they're broadly categorized to either they're inherited or they're non-inherited. Sometimes you call them as the environmental risk factors. So this pancreatic cancer or pancreatic adenocarcinoma aggregates in a few families. Approximately 10% is what we say the patients who are diagnosed with these cancers have a positive family history. And few studies did identify few susceptibility genes such as BRCA, ATM. And another inherited characteristic that we're talking about is ABO blood type, because bigger studies like Nurse Health Study and Health Professional Follow-Up Studies, and they compared the patients with blood group O and other blood group types, and what they found was there seems to be a little bit higher risk of incidence of pancreatic cancer in the patients with non-O blood group. And these findings were validated in a genome-wide association study later. And of course, there needs to be additional studies in a prospective manner to confirm these findings. And the patients with the cystic fibrosis, they do have increased risk for the pancreatic cancer, and chronic pancreatitis is also a risk factor as well. And so there are a few other epidemiological studies. They pointed out the association between diabetes and pancreatic cancer. And coming to the environmental risk factors, and the smoking, alcohol, and the diet, like high calorie intake, they were considered to be a risk factors for these malignancies.
Dr. Jacob, what are some of the hallmarks and the clinical presentation of pancreatic cancer? What are some of the first signs and symptoms?
Well, Melanie, the commonest symptom related to pancreatic cancer is the development of jaundice. Jaundice is, as you all know, is the yellowing of the eyes and skin, and this can happen due to the obstruction of bile ducts due to an enlarging pancreatic tumor. Because of the obstruction to the bile ducts, there could be impaired biliary flow into the bowel, which can result in light-colored stools or greasy stools. This can also happen due to insufficient pancreatic enzymes which are produced within the pancreas. So the ability to digest food may be impaired. This can lead to weight loss or poor appetite, fatigue. Some patients have nausea and vomiting because of block of bile duct or because the tumor pressing in the duodenum. And finally, pain or bellyache is also a common symptom that patients present with, because pancreas has a very rich nexus of nerves. So pain can be sometimes very excruciating and typically in the upper abdomen. Rare symptoms such as blood clots or gallbladder enlargement, liver enlargement can happen. And also, there's a percentage of patients who present with diabetes. Diabetes, as you know, is the due to abnormally high blood sugar levels, which occur due to reduced production of insulin within the pancreas. And the reduction in pancreatic insulin occurs because of the cancer cells diminishing the activity of insulin-making cells. So these are the common symptoms with which patients present.
Dr. Rose, it would seem that one of the most important aspects, and before we get in to some of the newer treatments, is early diagnosis. And tell us how important that is to improve outcome prediction, and what are some valuable tools that you're using to aid in this early diagnosis? I mean, Dr. Jacob has just mentioned jaundice and such, but speak about what else you are using and how important this is.
Well, like most cancers, the outcomes are closely tied to how advanced the cancer is when we find it. So very early stage pancreas cancers, those that have not left the pancreas or metastasized or involve the lymph nodes, have much more favorable outcomes. We have about a 40% chance of curing people if they don't have metastatic disease or involve lymph nodes. If they have no metastatic disease but their lymph nodes are involved, that drops down to about 20% if they're able to get full treatment. Unfortunately, we don't have good screening tests for pancreas cancer. Oftentimes, we find this because of one of the symptoms that Dr. Jacob mentioned. And about 50% of the time, that's at a point where the tumor has already spread to another organ. And about 30% of the time where it has spread in the region of the pancreas to the point that makes resection difficult. So this can be a rather difficult disease to diagnose. Some people are looking at ways to diagnose this earlier using certain markers in the bloodstream, but we really don't have any good evidence that is ready to be implemented in the clinics today.
Dr. Pelluri, how important is disease staging as an essential factor in PDAC therapies? Tell us also what's going on with genetics and early detection.
Sure, Melanie. As Dr. Rose just pointed out, about the prognostic factors. And I think we need the staging workup upfront to identify these high-risk factors because they are the one that will determine in future the overall prognosis. So essentially the goal of the staging workup is to assess the extent of the disease spread to the lymph nodes or to the other organs and also identify those patients who are eligible for the resection with the curative intent. And so at this time, we are staging with the TNM of AJCC, and I think the version currently is 8th edition, 2017. And coming to your next question about the genetics and the early detection, as I mentioned earlier, about 10% of the patients have a possible hereditary or the genetic component, and that can be attributed to the genetic causes. There are essentially two categories in there as well. So one is a genetic predisposition syndrome. For instance, if the patient has hereditary breast cancer or ovarian cancer, and they are at high risk of developing the pancreatic cancer as well. And the other syndromes are hereditary pancreatitis, Lyframeni syndrome, and there are a few others as well. And the second category is the familial pancreatic cancer, and these are the patients who does not have a genetic predisposition risk, but they are defined as a family with pair of at least there are two first degree relatives who had pancreatic cancer in them. So that's why at the time of the history and physical, it's very important to have a personal and a family history in detail, because if you suspect any of them, and a genetic counseling, a referral to the genetic counselor would help in identifying the germline component. So a few studies were undertaken to identify, the strategies to detect early, but they were not successful. Part of the reason is, you know, what studies have shown was there is no difference in the overall survival when they screen everybody. And also because the screening involves this detection with endoscopic ultrasound, sometimes these modalities itself will put the patient at risk for some adverse effects. So what studies are suggesting is you look at only that very selected subgroup of the patients who are at high risk because of these genetic issues to have the screening. And otherwise, there is no formal screening strategies at this time for the pancreatic cancer for the general population, just like we do colonoscopies for the colon cancer.
And I would like to add to Dr. Puluri's comments that there is some work being done, mostly in single institution centers, looking at genetic components that may predict response to treatment. There's some very early data suggesting in a single institution trial that by using a six-gene panel that we may be able to predict better who is going to respond to which type of chemotherapy. And that could be very useful in the future, but as we mentioned before, it's not quite ready for prime time.
Dr. Rose, sticking with you for just a minute, speak about some of the current issues in medical or surgical management and how important, when you are diagnosing and staging this, is patient selection. And if it's metastasized, then that changes what you would decide to do, yes?
It's extremely important. I think that, you know, as a surgeon, I can have an impact on this disease if it's a local disease. But unfortunately, the aggressiveness of pancreatic cancer and the lack of the effectiveness of our systemic treatments currently limits a little bit what we can do with metastatic disease. For disease that is still contained to the pancreas or the region of the pancreas and hasn't spread to distant organs, then patient selection becomes key. These operations to remove these tumors are very complex. They carry with them significant morbidity, both in the short and long term, with impacts in quality of life. So it's somebody that you really have to have a good discussion with these patients and make sure that they're in optimal fitness before embarking on a surgical resection.
Such an important point. So now let's talk about some of the new ways to approach it, including some of the combination or targeted or adjuvant therapies. Dr. Puluri, we'll start with you.
Starting with the adjuvant treatments, so, you know, a few years ago, it started with a single drug to be given in post-operative setting, and recent ASCO update showed that giving three cytotoxic drugs, FOLFIRINOX, have significantly improved overall survival compared to the single agent. And in addition to that, the targeted therapies are making their way into some subpopulation of the patients whose tumors have certain mutations. And immunotherapy alone did not show that much of the promising outcome, but they do have role in very highly selected subgroup. And now there have been few studies that are ongoing with the combination of targeted and immunotherapies. And also the combination of radiation and chemotherapies, and it also seemed to be a very effective strategy. We do have a protocol here at UAB. And then another important I want to bring to the attention is sequence of the treatment. So there have been a significant changes recently the way we treat these cancers. It used to be you start with the surgery if the cancer seems to be resectable, then proceed with adjuvant chemotherapy. But what they found was there has been a lot of recurrence rates in spite of the surgery upfront followed by adjuvant. So now the needle is moving towards total neoadjuvant, where you start with a neoadjuvant chemotherapy. That means you give chemotherapy upfront, and then you do the surgery and followed by chemotherapy or the radiation, depending upon whatever the outcome it is from the pathology.
Well, I would just say I'd like to echo what Dr. Puluri mentioned, in that, you know, after an operation, it's extremely difficult for these patients to get all their intended therapy. And only about 75% of these patients traditionally began adjuvant treatment or chemotherapy after their operation, with only maybe in best series, half of them completing all of their intended chemotherapy. So it was very difficult for these patients even to get a single agent after a large pancreatic operation, which is one of the reasons why we've been switching to giving it to them prior to the operation to ensure that they get adequate systemic treatment.
And as this is this kind of panel discussion is so multidisciplinary and fascinating that I'm able to have all three of you on to speak about the succession of treatment. Let's look a little bit on the horizon and in the future of pancreatic cancer. So, Dr. Rose, I'd like to start with you. Some promising new therapies in the surgical area, and even you've talked about patient selection. So you tell us what you're seeing happen on the horizon and what you're doing at UAB that will be of interest to other providers.
You know, I think that the operation itself has not changed much in the last half a century, but what we've gotten much better at is getting patients with more advanced disease to the operating room, having them recover more quickly and getting on to intended treatment at higher rates than they used to be. So I think now that we have some better systemic treatment, we've switched to giving treatment up front with chemotherapy and now potentially adding radiation as a component to that. We're operating on people that before had very advanced disease locally that involved not only mesenteric veins, but also arteries, where their resection of the tumor along with these major vessels was not associated with an improved outcome. But in large institutional series, we're starting to see that may change. And that is most likely due to this new combination treatment approach where they're giving most of their treatment up front.
That's fascinating. Now, Dr. Jacob, to you, and I'd like you to talk about the horizon picture a little bit, too, as a radiation oncologist. Where is your role in this now, and is it coming in even before surgical intervention?
Okay, Melanie, as was mentioned, pancreatic cancer requires multi-modality, multi-specialty treatment, and as a radiation oncologist, my role is, number one, to improve the likelihood of Dr. Rose being able to remove the tumor by surgery. And I can facilitate this by shrinking the tumor. And if, for whatever reason, the tumor continues to be inoperable, even after chemotherapy and radiation, then the radiation should be able to reduce the likelihood of regrowth and also to prevent local symptoms. And by local symptoms, I specifically mean pain, which is a very common local symptom, and obstruction. So that being the role of radiation, in the coming years, I hope that we'll see more precise delivery of radiation to the target. Already radiation is delivered in a very highly accurate fashion. Accuracy is in the order of millimeters. We would see the accuracy improve even further so that there is very little spill of radiation to the surrounding local normal structures where we don't want the radiation to go. And as you know, side effects happen when radiation spills to the surrounding structures. And so we'll see techniques being developed which will limit the dose spill to normal structures. There will be increasing use of stereotactic radiation, which is highly focused radiation delivered over 5 or 6 treatments instead of the classic 25 to 30 treatments. We are likely to see increasing use of radiation prior to surgery, even though there is no evidence right now. There are a number of institutions which are looking into the role of treating patients prior to surgery in all patients. It is likely that there could be a benefit. And finally, we will be making use of techniques such as proton therapy, which fortunately UAB is acquiring a proton machine, which will be operational in 2020. We'll be making use of the proton machine to more precisely direct our radiation to the target. So these are some of the advances that I see in the immediate future in pancreatic cancer care from the radiation oncology perspective.
And Dr. Puluri, from your perspective as a hematologist medical oncologist, tell us your horizon picture and how this multidisciplinary and multimodal approach to pancreatic cancer really involves all of you and what you see happening.
So, from the medical oncology standpoint, I want to mention that there have been few challenges in terms of developing the systemic treatment, the chemotherapy. If you look into the last 5 years, there were not many approvals for the pancreatic cancer. This all boils down to the inherent complex biology of these cancers. So this points the need to manage these cancers in a multidisciplinary manner. And the best way to handle any treatment for the pancreatic cancer patients, as suggested by the NCCN guidelines or any other national guidelines, is to treat the patient on the clinical trials. So if you look into the clinicaltrials.gov, now there are several trials with the combination of targeted treatments and also immunotherapies looking into the fine spot where how to get to the right point where they can treat these cancers in a better manner. So at UAB, and we do have a clinical trials, and one of the trial is, again, the multidisciplinary interventions, just like what we all talked about, looking at the sequence. That means we give chemo or radiation upfront, and looking at the strategy. So we have a locally advanced cancer trial where we treat the patients with chemotherapy followed by stereotactic body radiation, and if that becomes resectable, and they will be going for the surgery. So this is how, so we, all the three disciplines will interact to manage these cancers.
Fascinating. Dr. Rose, last word to you. Tell other physicians what you'd like them to know about pancreatic cancer and when you feel it's really important to refer to UAB medicine.
Yeah, I think that the important message here is that, you know, pancreatic cancer can be treatable. It's important to have, especially patients who have no evidence of metastatic disease, should be seen by a surgeon. And even those patients who do have metastatic disease really should consider being seen by somebody to discuss clinical trials, of which Dr. Pilleri mentioned that we have a number here. But you know, there was a study that was done over a decade ago now that found that even patients with the earliest stage of cancer were only getting referred to surgery about 40% of the time. And I think it's very important to have patients be evaluated in a multidisciplinary fashion at all stages of disease before they decide to go on to palliative treatment. Lastly, I'd like to mention that in order for us to provide a truly multidisciplinary care experience at UAB, we have launched a pancreatobiliary disease center that brings all of the people that have been on this MedCast, along with other providers in surgical oncology, medical, radiation oncology, pathology, transplant, critical care, genetics, together, including advanced GI and IR, and really treat these patients in a true multidisciplinary fashion. Patients can be referred directly to our center and can contact us either through our website or at 1-833-UAB-4-PDC, the Pancreatobiliary Disease Center. We look forward to helping in any way that we can and working with all providers within the community and all aspects of care for these complex patients.
Thank you, gentlemen, so much for joining us today and for sharing your expertise and explaining the sequencing and what you see on the horizon for pancreatic cancer. Thank you again for coming on the show. A community physician can refer a patient to UAB Medicine by calling the MIST line at 1-800-UAB-MIST. That's 1-800-822-6478. You're listening to UAB Medcast. For more information on resources available at UAB Medicine, you can go to uabmedicine.org/physician. That's uabmedicine.org/physician. This is Melanie Cole. Thanks so much for listening.